This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe. RedIceCreations.com.
Welcome back. This is Henrik, and you are listening to Red Ice Radio. Today, we're doing a follow-up program with Daniel Pinchbeck, who was with us way back in 2006. We want to see what direction he's been heading in and what areas he's been focusing on since writing the books Breaking Open the Head and 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl. Daniel is an American author living in New York's East Village, where he is the editorial director of Reality Sandwich, a blog website centered on sustainability to shamanism, alternate realities to alternative energy, remixing media to reimagining community, holistic healing techniques to the promise and perils of new technologies. Pinchbeck is also a contributor to the New York Times Magazine, Esquire and Rolling Stone, among other publications, and he is currently the editorial director of Evolver Magazine and the Evolver Project. Welcome back to Red Ice Radio, Daniel Pinchbeck. Almost 6 years ago since we last spoke. It's incredible. It's a different world today, for sure. It's good to talk to you again, Daniel. Obviously, I wanted to ask you a little bit about what's new with you, about your work and everything else. But first, how have you been? How's your 6 years been, Daniel?
No, they've been amazing. Yeah, you know, so much has happened, and I've learned so much, and you know, I'm still here, and you know, it's the big cusp of the big year coming up.
It sure is. A lot of things going on, and what have you learned new pertaining to the whole phenomena of 2012 and Mayanism and everything else that's kind of going on right now? It seems to have evolved and changed slightly, as it always does, of course. But how do you see that from your perspective, Daniel?
Well, let's see. I mean, that's a huge question.
Or are we on track? Is things kind of chugging along as you expected, you know, back in 2006, let's say, or earlier?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so many things are happening, you know, simultaneously that it's, you know, a little bit difficult to, you know, make overarching generalizations, but it seems as if, you know, there's an ongoing, you know, global financial meltdown happening. You know, there's this Occupy movement, you know, rose up last year, then kind of dissipated for the time being. But I found that to be a very important phenomenon. And something that I would think is related to this prophetic transition. And yeah, we see accelerating climate change, you know, the potential for breakthrough energy technologies to emerge at the same time. We're seeing, you know, resource depletion, accelerating species extinction, horrifying industrial accidents, you know, such as the Gulf oil spill and Fukushima in Japan. And I think generally a quickening in awareness. You know, people seem much more open in general to new ideas. I mean, you know, or you could say there are people who are maintaining, you know, their blockade, but then other people are developing quickly and sort of awakening. So yeah, I sort of do feel that we are, you know, whatever on track means. I mean, it's never been my theory that something, you know, drastic was going to happen on December 21st, 2012.
Right.
But, you know, that this time is the hinge, of a tremendous process of like change and development and kind of, either, you know, a birthing of a new level of human consciousness and a new form of planetized society, or, you know, something that's, you know, the descent into, you know, a really horrific scenario, you know, with, you know, drastic consequences and maybe even the termination of our species on the planet. You know, I think that it's looking, you know, right on the mark, you know, for being that hinge point.
It's definitely polarized, that's for sure. I don't think many people would argue with that. is it's pretty balanced between these two at this point, though? I mean, it seems to me, and I've said this many times before, we're kind of waning back and forth between both tragedy and hope at the same time. And one day you could feel energized and spirited up, uplifted, if you will, and other days it's really heavy and really discouraging about what's happening in the world. But I guess that's all part of a time of transformation, I guess. What's your take on that, Daniel?
I maintain a kind of underlying, optimism, where I really look at it as an evolutionary process, you know, much like a birthing process. And, birthing processes are convulsive and violent and painful. But even all of the resistance, you know, is kind of necessary for the new being to emerge. So that's kind of the way I would see it, I guess.
Do you think that many other, tragedies, in a sense, accidents and everything else that you mentioned before, economic meltdown and things, are ultimately things that are aiding in the awakening, if that's what we can call it?
Yeah, well, they're obviously necessary, because we're not going to, embrace, our potential for radical transformation, unless we're pushed to the edge. I mean, one of the hypotheses that I developed in my book, 2012, Return of Quetzalcoatl, was that, on some kind of unconscious level, humanity is pushing itself into an initiatory crisis in order to bring about a transformation or even transmutation of planetary consciousness.
So maybe you can talk a little bit about the larger picture, maybe, of where you see all of this is going. If we follow through on one of these ideas that we're going to, in some way, that we're forced to change and transform, and what are we looking at in ahead here? How are things going to change? And is it going to be ultimately for the better of the whole planet? Or maybe I'm simplifying it too much, Daniel.
So my personal view is that, ultimately, I can't say, of course, exactly how long this will take. It could take many years. It could be much faster. We're going to kind of, embrace a new kind of, mythological understanding or a new paradigm. And as one aspect of that new worldview will be an acceptance of, you could say spirituality, or you could say, psychic dimensions, mm-hmm. Or psychic energy. One of the ideas would be that, in the same way, we discovered, quote unquote, electricity in the 18th century and then started to use that, took a while. A lot of failed experiments until we learned how to channel it and transmit it and use it responsibly or whatever. We're kind of at a similar threshold with psychic energy or psychic capacities. And, if we look at electricity, we see that in 150 years, once we discovered that and learned how to use it, we were able to change the whole surface of the Earth. It's possible that this next level of energy that we're now accessing, which you could define as like psychic energy, mm-hmm. Is something that could transform the surface of the planet and human society at an exponentially faster rate.
Interesting. Now, how do you see this already coming into the world? Are there any examples of this, maybe in your own life or what you've seen around you, that seems to indicate that this is where things indeed are going?
Good question. I think many people have experienced it as, first of all, the acceptance of synchronicity as a kind of, what Carl Jung talked about as an acausal ordering principle, that almost as if, that underlying the apparent kind of chaos of events, there's some kind of, purposeful momentum or kind of a logic, suggests that, the separation that we experience, between ourselves as individuals, maybe is actually partially an illusion, and underlying that there's actually a kind of unity of consciousness, you know, which is what most of the esoteric traditions, you know, speak about, you know, such as Vedanta or whatever. So then we've seen, obviously, like pilot projects, you know, using psychic energies for remote healing, remote prayer. We've seen, you know, the transcendental meditation experiments where they've reduced, you know, incidents of violent crime in high homicide districts. We've got the Global Consciousness Project where they've registered, you know, fluctuations in random number generation that are greatest at the type, you know, when there are global events and so on. So, and, you know, there's the experiments they're doing at IONS and Supernoetic Sciences, you know, Rupert Sheldrake's work, et cetera. I think all of this is pointing towards, you know, our growing capacity to approach, you know, this whole domain of psychic research and experiment, you know, without losing our grounding or being thrown into the irrational. And I think that's one crucial piece of what this evolution is going to entail. It's also very interesting to me that we see it constantly reflected and presented to us in the form of our most popular media. You know, it's almost as if, in a way, you could see that these media artifacts are, you know, accessing some very deep innate. Intuitive knowing inside of us. So if you look at Harry Potter or Star Wars or The Matrix or Avatar, you know, they're all telling the same Lord of the Rings. They're all telling the same story over and over again, which is that there's kind of, you know, an initiatory process that the individual has to undergo to kind of use the force or master the Matrix, you know, or gain, you know, the skills of the wizard or whatever. And, you know, people are just seeing this as story, but I would see it more as like presentiment, you know, or precedent, you know, for aspects of this new reality that we'll ultimately co-create.
Interesting. Now, what do you see about, it's very difficult, of course, to answer, I understand that, but if you have an idea about how quick you see this coming about and implementing, I don't know if we can compare it to, as you said before, his other historical events. But it's also been suggested, of course, that we're generally in a time period where things tend to accelerate. So therefore, even a big step forward in one way or another would go potentially faster than it did, a couple of hundred years ago. So with that in mind, do you think that this is something that will pretty quickly come into a realization on a bigger scale and hence later just be implemented, or are we looking at something that still is a couple of hundred years away? What do you think?
I think it's going to happen within the next 10 to 20 years.
Wow. And do you think that this is something that, again, then is going to come about? You mentioned some examples here of how we're reminded, if you will, of these stories on the big screen and whatnot. But ultimately, is this an inner realization, or again, does it come from an external study, perhaps, of new kind of research and information that you mentioned before, that people need to come into that and actually understand and hence, you know, incorporate that information into themselves to understand it, or is this just organically going to grow within people? What do you think?
Well, I would say both. I mean, that's partially what I've done with my books, like the 2012 and Breaking Open the Head, and then also, you know, the works of people like, you know, Jose Arguelles. We actually just published his last book. He died last spring, called Manifesto for the Newosphere, where he lays out his whole, you know, hypothesis of this kind of emerging psychic level of interconnectivity and this capacity to kind of envision and then recreate, you know, the earth as an art whole, you know. I think that, you know, I very much, you know, agree with these ideas of like the tipping point or the morphogenic field effect.
Yeah.
You know, as individuals, you know, go through the process, you know, at first it's very cumbersome and laborious, you know, as it was for me, to kind of access these different levels of ideas and information, to integrate them, you know, part of it being, you know, a shift from, you know, the dualism of the Western thought to the non-dual perspective of kind of like an Eastern understanding, or, you know, even the you know, kind of Shemitic kind of anima mundi alchemical, you know, realization. You know, there are all these different levels of spirit and being, but ultimately they're like enfolded within, you know, one form of kind of unity consciousness that underlies it. So as you, you know, and so at first it's cumbersome, you know, it's a huge effort to integrate this, but as more people do it, it then becomes more communicable. You know, it becomes more part of the vernacular, and then more people are you know, turning onto it quicker and quicker. And I think that that's what's happening in a number of areas. I see that happening. And as I said, I see that those people who have been, you know, intensifying their awareness and awakening are able to absorb, you know, new potentials and new ideas faster and faster. And recently I've been seeing this in the areas of alternative economic models, and also alternative possibilities for love, sexuality, and relationship.
Now, it is difficult, and it seems to have been difficult for a while to bring in new ideas. I'm thinking about, still, this is work that is pretty well documented from a scientific point of view. You mentioned Rupert Sheldrake, there's others like Clive Baxter, and certainly many more. But still, in the mainstream, that's considered to be... Well, I don't know what they call it. I guess they call it pseudoscience in a way still. So it seems like that push is still... Do you feel that it's closer right now, though, than it has been in the past? Is it gaining a little more momentum at this stage, do you think?
Well, I mean, the thing about it is that, you know, the sort of study and experiment around psychic phenomena, you know, and psychic energy... is ultimately you know, a slightly different paradigm, you know, than the traditional you know, materialist science that we've developed up to this point,
right?
Because it cannot be separate from the ontological or phenomenological subjective experience. So you know, it's almost like a new model needs to emerge. And you know, some of that model comes from, you know, shamanism. I mean, as I wrote about in my book, you know, the Hopi Indians in Arizona, you know, a lot of their ritual culture is around, you know, bringing rain into a very dry landscape. You know, an anthropologist who spent years, you know, living with the Hopi, a Cambridge-trained anthropologist, Peter Whiteley, I think his name was, he admitted that, you know, to his shock and, you know, kind of almost embarrassment, that the rain dances seemed to sometimes work, you know, that he would go to these, you know, rituals and, you know, they would do these dances, and after 20 minutes, you know, clouds would gather and, you know, cover the blazing hot sun, and rain would start to fall. Didn't happen all the time, but it happened enough so that he recognized that he was witnessing something, you know, beyond his scientific explanatory grids. You know, I've seen that same phenomena over and over again. You know, for instance, you know, concerts where, you know, the incredible storm is beckoning, but the storm actually just holds out till the very, very last note of the encore, and then suddenly, you know, erupts. You know, I've seen, you know, recently we had, this is going to sound almost like New Agey or trite perhaps, we had a Evolver Convergence. Evolver is my organization, it's a company and a volunteer organization. We had we brought a whole bunch of people together in Pittsburgh, including the organizers from around the U.S. and Canada. And after the closing ceremony, we had a meditation, and you know, during it there was a storm. 1 minute after the meditation ended, there was a huge double rainbow across the sky. You know, so I actually think that what we're relearning, you know, in you know, at the cutting edge, is that, you know, the kind of human consciousness, you know, our subtle electromagnetic field has a direct effect on our environment.
That's very interesting. Obviously, that's a thing that would be beneficial. You talked about climate change before, and just now in the last few weeks, we've seen incredible heat waves in the U.S. There's floods in Russia, and the weather is kind of weird right now. So in that aspect, if that's something we can influence, that's pretty interesting. It's also something that would be helpful and beneficial. What in some other areas do you see that this could help us, let's say, in the Western world, or even change us if we understand this connectivity or how it can be used, How do you think that we as humans, or even our world and surrounding cities, whatever you want to talk about there, how would that change, do you see?
Wow, I mean, I actually didn't expect to just go off and off into this area, but I mean, I think, you know, we can't even yet envision it totally, because we'd have to take some steps in that area. But I mean, sure, you know, sure. Elizabeth Targ, who unfortunately passed away, but she was the daughter of the remote viewing expert, Russell Targ. You know, she was doing experiments with remote healing via prayer for cancer, and was having really astonishing results. So probably, you know, we could see mass visioning for healing, both of people and the damage to the environment. And it's not like to do that alone, you know, but also to do that in you know, in consonance with, you know, a deeper, you know, application of practical skills and our technical abilities to, you know, restoring the environment and you know, disseminating, you know, alternative health modalities and all that kind of stuff. You know, and I think, like, you know, yeah, I mean, you know, it's really not to lapse into you know, magical thinking at this point, mm-hmm. but you know, I think that the evidence, you know, whether you look at, you know, what I just talked about from the Hopi or Dean Radin's work, like the, you know, what is, like the self-aware universe, self-conscious universe, you know, the tremendous evidence points towards there being, you know, real effects here. You know, then the next obvious phase would be to, you know, kind of marshal a global, you know, project towards using these capacities.
Now, what are some of the big areas you've been working on since we last talked? You obviously, when we talked in 2006, you had your first book out at that point, Breaking Open the Head, and then later, don't know the year, you can enlighten us about that, 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl came out. I wanted to ask you just a little bit about that, if you could introduce a little bit about some of your ideas and work to us for potential newcomers, or if there's something like new and exciting that you're working on right now, Daniel, that you really would like to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl came out in 2006. It became a kind of surprise bestseller. It's a very dense and philosophical book. The thrust of the book was exploring the prophecies of indigenous people around this time and correlating those prophecies with different aspects of Western philosophy and Western thought, and also my own personal, you know, subjective experience as I underwent the process of studying this. So that investigation took me to the crop circles in England, which I ended up, supporting the thesis that those are actually, you know, not just a human-made phenomenon, they're actually an interaction, you know, between, you know, human consciousness and some form of galactic or, you know, interdimensional consciousness. Continuing the path of psychedelics, working with ayahuasca in Brazil, with the Santo Daime, with, you know, DMT and other substances, you know, and so on. So, yeah, the sort of end product of that book was accepting that, you know, the prophetic framing of these indigenous cultures, you know, has truth to it, and that we are in this time of upheaval and regeneration, and then, you know, becoming aware that, you know, we need to become active, you know, co-creators and participants, you know, in the evolutionary process, and so that naturally led me then to want to become, you know, not just a writer and a commenter, but actually to help to kind of build, you know, infrastructure or models, you know, for this new planetary culture. So that led me to start my company, ultimately Evolver. Evolver.net is relaunching in a few days. And then we have EvolverNetwork.org, which is the nonprofit. But at the moment, we have 35 or 40 local groups that meet up around the world. I would have to say that, you know, this talk is an invitation to anybody who's interested in what we're doing to, you know, get in touch with us, You know, even email me directly, daniel@evolver.net, if you'd be interested in starting a local group. Basically, you know, our thinking was, you know, what is the simplest scaffolding that we can offer people to help them to construct, you know, local communities, you know, where people are exploring transformative practices and new ideas, sort of cutting edge possibilities. So we created this Evolver network. We have local groups that we humorously call spores, who do monthly events. And we create network-wide themes that can range. Actually, the next one is climate change. Recent ones have been on, you know, the future of psychedelic research, you know, love relationships, peace activism. You know, so the monthly events provide kind of opportunities for communities to gather and bring in local experts in different areas. And then the idea is just to keep, you know, building a network until there's really a groundswell towards this transformative model. When we see a permaculture to be an important part of it, we see local currencies to be a big part of it. And, you know, but then also, you know, kind of you know, authentic spirituality that, you know, doesn't necessarily have to have a religious context or any kind of dogma to it, mm-hmm. but is about kind of reestablishing, you know, our relationship to, you know, both the natural world and the larger cosmos.
Now, I've been following on and off your other website, realitysandwich.com. I think you're the founder or co-founder of that, Daniel.
Yeah, Reality Sandwich is one of our, you know, kind of projects through Evolver. Reality Sandwich is ongoing. And we also now publish books, Evolver Editions. You can check out the roster of books, evolvereditions.com. We have new books coming out. I'm the executive editor of that series. One of them is called The Media Ecosystem. It's a really, I think, amazing examination of, you know, the impact of media on human society and what we would need to do to create like a healthy media ecosystem.
Interesting. A lot of different topics discussed, of course, on the website, everything from, I would say, consciousness to shamanism. What are some of the big points in there that you see are important that you're trying to get out, I guess, with the online magazine and everything else? At this time as well, Daniel, this is things that always change. Of course, you progress forward. Many of the authors that you have on the website, or some of the people there, is folks we've interviewed here as well. So in that way, we have a similar kind of interest for new concepts, new ideas. And ultimately, what would you say it's about? Is it about, I mean, because with the groups that you talked about before, that's about injecting new ideas, I guess, into the mass consciousness of people out there, and the more widespread this is on the globe, I guess, the more of an impact that would have. Is that the idea, kind of, if you will, behind it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess ultimately the idea is to, you know, get people to start thinking for themselves.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, I think, like, you know, we have a very, very cunning and tricky, you know, mainstream, you know, corporate media environment that's totally, you know, enmeshed with, you know, the government, you know, and education, institutional systems, and so on. And, you know, for the most part, you know, people are not taught to think. You know, they're actually, you know, given a bunch of stuff to believe in, and they're told, like, this is how it is, you know. But you know, they're kind of indoctrinated, you know. So yeah, I guess that's one, you know, big division. You know, I see that, like, you know, in these shamanic cultures or in, like, ancient mystery traditions, like, you know, the mysteries of Eleusis or Egypt or whatever. The whole idea is, you know, people have to undergo, you know, an individual process of initiation that you know, requires you to develop your personal relationship with the mystery and to kind of, like, you know, reach your own, you know, deeper understanding and connection. In our culture, I mean, you know, if you look at the patriarchal religious structures or, you know, the, you know, systems of nationalism and all that stuff, you know, the people just, you know, the people are just converted into consumers, and consciousness is actually mass produced by the media factory.
Yeah.
You know, so basically there's like the media is creating a standardized form of consciousness, just like there's like a widget in a factory. And you know, the problem is that you know, that this whole system and structure that's been created is delusional, and is kind of leading us, you know, rapidly towards planetary catastrophe.
That's a very interesting concept, of course, one we've been pondering a lot on this program as well. What that comes from, what drives that, and people's willingness to jump into that without actually, as you said before, thinking for themselves. I don't know if this is a pertinent question then, but and if you're a kind of a gauge for that, but do you notice in any way that it's more difficult today to try to encourage people to think for themselves, or is it gradually becoming easier? Is there a willingness, if you will, generally from people of actually trying to disconnect from this media monster out there that just, you know, churning out this kind of one-size-fits-all consciousness, as you said?
Yeah, well, it's actually several sizes fit different classes. You know, so you have, for instance, like more sophisticated media, like in America, like the New Yorker, which kind of takes the secular materialist, you know, bourgeois corporate philosophy and gives it a kind of sophisticated sheen. You know, so it has people, engaged in that way. Mm-hmm. But and then there's a more lowbrow, like New York Post or Fox News approach. It has different pitches for different levels of consciousness or bandwidths.
But they're all churned out from the same central headquarters, it seems like, in a way. It's just different.
Obviously these questions around conspiracy are deep labyrinths. What was your initial question again?
Well, if you notice that it's, I guess, easier for people to,
Much easier. I think that people are awakening faster and faster. And more people are open, and I think that's also very much a product of the internet and social networks and social media, which are actually having a transformative effect on human consciousness.
Absolutely, and if I can play devil's advocate a little bit here, then how is it? Do you find it difficult to? Because ultimately, if we're looking for people to think for themselves, we don't want them to fall into other brackets out there that exist in one way or another. Is there a danger that a subculture eventually becomes the mainstream culture, and then in a certain way we're kind of stuck in the same mode again, if you know what I mean, Daniel?
That's certainly a danger. Cult and culture are so related that it's even hard to say if there's a difference.
Yeah, I agree.
When we use language, we're immediately, in the mythological realm. The question is really, that's why I really like the model of art, or, Buckminster Fuller's whole philosophy around, design science. Let's recognize, that and, constantly, tiptoe back from the edge of, falling into whirlpools of belief and ideology and rigidity and faith, and, figure out how we use all these tools that we have to, create the most awesome situation that we could possibly make for ourselves.
So it's about authenticity, the real stuff, in a way, and cutting through all the bullshit, all the layers out there that are created for us, or we set them out for ourselves in certain cases, maybe to hide or escape. There's various different reasons why people do this, and sometimes I can understand that there's a function to it, perhaps. But ultimately, I think most people generally actually do want some kind of authenticity. How, in your view, do we get there? How can we get closer to reality in that sense?
I was just going to mention, maybe you know this already, but there was Yogi Bhajan, the guy who's he was the lineage holder of Kundalini Yoga. He had all these devoted followers, and one day they were asking him, Yogi Bhajan, what's going to be the true meaning of this age of Aquarius that's coming? And he just answered, no more bullshit.
Yeah.
I just found that to be very resonant as a concept. So wait, what was your question again?
Well, if there's any, if there's any tools or modalities that you use to come closer to reality, so we can cut through all the bullshit, as you just said as well, referring back to the yogi there, because there's so there's a lot out there, and there's various levels, it seems like, of illusions, both created for us, but also that we willingly go into. So how do we get away from that? I mean, is shamanism, for example, a tool to get closer to it?
Well, totally. I mean, I think that I'm a psychedelic person, and I think that tripping done properly and judiciously, is an extreme tool for cutting through. And kind of deconditioning yourself and, seeing, because basically, for most people, in general, we all have an ego, and I don't think it's, we don't want to destroy the ego or lose the ego, but we want to attain what this philosopher Gene Gebser described as a state of ego freedom. I think what normally happens is, let's say you have a psychedelic experience and you kind of, your ego is deconstructed. And then you're back in society and it starts to build up again. And maybe you even begin to feel that you're like a big shot, because, you're all shamanic now or something. But then you can go back and have that experience, that exquisitely humbling experience, once again. And, it's funny, actually. I sometimes feel that there are people in the meditation world who, and I feel, because if they don't have that psychedelic experience, the ego kind of builds up, even though it's more like a kind of higher egoic form. It's like a spiritualized ego, like they're the best meditator or their yoga is the best kind of yoga or whatever, but that's just another head trip, I think that's a great value of the psychedelic plants. Although there again, I also see people, kind of figuring out, the plant, where they'll be working with ayahuasca, and at first it's having this great effect on them, and they're actually more connected and have found some kind of spiritual truth. But then their minds, they sort of learn to use the state, and their minds kind of begin to play tricks on them, and another kind of trip or ego thing kind of manifests. So, the feedback, the feedback from the plants is one thing. And I really do believe that these plants are, and some of these chemicals even are teacher, archaic wisdom teachers who seek to, bring us into resonance, with the Gaian matrix or something. But then another aspect of it is, just constantly checking in. Hopefully if you're lucky, as your ego begins to, grow, you get knocked down. I mean, Yogananda said that, life is a constant choice between humility or humiliation.
Do you think that we can contribute some of that to overuse of the plants that we, some people begin to try to deconstruct it and maybe try to figure it out, as you said before, or can we attribute that just to human curiosity to in a certain extent? We do want to know. We want to try to understand, and seems to be anyway analytical at heart. What do you think, Daniel?
I think there are different types of people. Some of them, are more, they just want to relax. Others of us have a almost desperate desire to seek and to know and to communicate and create. Others are more devotional. Their greatest bliss is, being in service or being in prayer. A lot of indigenous type people are kind of like that in a way. And that's very beautiful also, and in the perfect world, whatever we decide to co-create, I mean, that way of being will also be, encouraged,
But ultimately, it's something new, perhaps, that we're looking for, that you're looking for. We've seemed to have an incredible usage of hallucinogenic plants and entheogens and all that in the past, and seems to be a connection to certain sites around the world, sacred sites, temple built in a specific way to enhance the experience. There's a number of avenues we can go down there. But also, Daniel, I guess what you're saying is not we're not meant to go back there either. We're meant to go somewhere new. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think that, you know, people talk about like the Mayan understanding of time as being cyclical, you know, like the Yuga cycle or the Egyptian time frame. But I'd say it's more spiraling and, you know, you reach kind of a new level on the spiral. So I would say that, you know, this 5,125 year long count, which Jose Arguelles talks about, is kind of like a desynchronization period, you know, where we lost our synchrony with the natural world. We fell out of resonance with natural time and you know, forest time but that was necessary to develop, you know, our individual, you know, individuality to a great extent, our rational materialist, capacities to analyze and take apart matter and build, you know, supercomputers and all that kind of stuff. You know, I think that was all part of the evolutionary process. But then what happens at the end of the spiral or at this next phase that we're now going into is a kind of, you know, resynchronizing with the natural world and cosmic time. But at a new level of realization, a new level of self-understanding, and also a new level of technical capacity.
So this might be a boring question for you, Daniel, but I do want to ask it nonetheless. We are getting close to the Mayan end date and all that. Do you think in any capacity we're in for something extraordinary in the months ahead, or are we going to just kind of go forth as we have? I mean, certainly things are happening around us, as you said in the beginning. There's a number of world-changing disasters and everything else that has happened. So by no means is it ordinary, but I mean, anything specific in your view?
I mean, I just want to say that like there's always so much focus on that kind of question.
Sure.
And you know, I stopped even really thinking about it because, you know, what seems to be most valuable is to for us to really think to ourselves, okay, like once I understand, you know, the crises are not going away. You know, climate change is not going to diminish tomorrow. You know, the world is not going to go any less haywire, you know, anytime soon, you know, unless we bring about that change that somehow creates, you know, a peaceful and harmonic and you know, equitably, you know, reasonable planetary civilization. You know, so why don't I just put all of my energy into bringing that about? You know, because I could waste all the time that I want worrying about the conspiracies or, you know, worrying about catastrophes that are going to happen. But that's all stuff that I literally have so little control over, where I know that if I, you know, build community and find, you know, the most awesome projects and either support them myself or make media about them so more people learn about them, you know, that's of value.
Do you think that, maybe that's a polarized way of looking at it, but if we talk about the change, is it collective or individual? I mean, obviously both to a certain extent, I understand that, but what would you put more emphasis on, if any, Daniel?
Well, yeah, so as I keep, you know, pointing out to you, and I really feel that, you know, this non-duality is the, you know, part of this next level of consciousness. Mm-hmm. You know, this next level of realization, and you know, the individual and the collective. Yeah, I would say that's a false dualism, you know, and especially now when we're all more and more aware of how interconnected we are. You know, I mean, you know, whether that's, you know, like, you know, it used to be that you could take your, you know, garbage and you feel like you could throw it away somewhere and it would never come back. You know, but now we know that it's, you know, the plastic is going into the ocean and it's affecting the fishes and that gets eaten by the birds or whatever. And then it ends up back in our endocrine system. You know, there's no more away anymore. You know, we're one planetary organism, you know, coming to consciousness of itself.
What are some of the other aspects you've been working on, Daniel? Or if you want to talk what's up next here for you, I guess it's a busy year for you overall.
Yeah, I mean, a major, you know, the major focus for me right now is my company, Evolver, One of the realizations that I had was that, you know, if you look at alchemy and you think about the alchemical idea that, you know, poisons are actually, you know, medicines, you know, depending on dosage, and the most terrible poison can be the greatest medicine. You know, and then we look at corporations, which have been the most destructive, you know, force on the planet, you know, but they're also an evolutionary advance, right? That we can create these artificial life forms out of brand identity and legal code and financial data and ideas and then use them to actually, you know, massively transform, you know, society and the biosphere as a whole. So it seemed to me that the necessity was to construct or create a corporation that, you know, was transformative in its essence. So that's what we've been doing with Evolver. And, you know, at the moment that includes, you know, the web magazine Reality Sandwich, you know, the learning. We do live interactive webinars, Evolver Intensives. We have one right now on shamanic breathwork and another one on like shamanic self-defense starting this week. We do retreats and events and conferences, and now we're going to start selling products and marketing goods and services that we believe will help people, you know, make a transition to a more regenerative and resilient lifestyle.
There's so many amazing things out there as well, Daniel, options to all the things I think we've been talking about from plastic and everything else. There's hemp solutions, different fibers, biodegradable stuff, and it is out there. And some days I feel it's going pretty slow, though. Where is the implementation? Where are the new, well, you know, free energy devices and all that? It's easy to get kind of a little bit disheartened at times as well. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that, you know, the way change happens is there's like a narrows and a constriction and then kind of a breakthrough. And around a lot of this stuff, I think that's what we're on the verge of. And, you know, one thing that I think needs to happen, you know, for those breakthroughs to occur is a new civil society infrastructure, you know, which is one of the things that we're seeking to create, you know, through Evolver. You know, that's why, you know, I can't help but, you know, think that people should join us on Evolver.net and sign up, you know, so they can find out what we're doing. But, yeah, so for instance, like, let's say we had, you know, 5 million or 10 million people, you know, in sort of a loosely affiliated organization, you know, we could go to a company like Apple and we could say, listen, you know, we love your products, we love what you produce, but, you know, we don't like that you don't, you know, recycle your components, you know, so after somebody's used up, you know, the computer, it just goes to a third world landfill where it leaches mercury and poisons children. You know, we also don't like your child labor practices. You know, we don't think that 15-year-olds should be making these things for, you know, pennies a day in a factory. You know, and we also don't like the fact that, you know, you could, you know, that would cost something at first, you know, use, you know, these other types of, you know, non-destructive polymers or, you know, really be researching environmentally friendly packaging, you know, there's all, yeah. So, you know, I think we need like a global civil society infrastructure that's like a lobbying organization that puts pressures on corporations to, you know, really become sustainable in the way that, you know, William McDonoghue discussed in the amazing book Cradle to Cradle.
Now, have you seen, I've heard other commentators talk about the corporatization of the green movement and everything else. Is that something you've witnessed as well? Because we do have a lot of organizations out there, powerful ones, Greenpeace, there's, you know, many, many more. What happened there? We're still kind of stuck, if you will. Why is it not moving faster, do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, and I, you know, there is a lot, you know, as I said, there's so many things happening simultaneously that it's, you know, you it's hard to parse out the general trends, you know, from all the specifics. And that's why I think it's always good to kind of like step back and take like an evolutionary perspective or a meta system perspective.
Yeah. Yeah.
And on that level, you know, we see that, you know, there is tremendous momentum, you know, towards, you know, kind of more ecological perspectives. I mean, even the fact that the corporations, you know, have to assimilate, you know, this language, you know, that just has to do with their bottom line, right? It's like offensive to too many people now, you know, if a company just continues acting in the old ways. And, you know, I think we're just going to see that growing by leaps and bounds. But those corporations are also, you know, a lot of them are trapped in the publicly traded sector, you know, which definitely makes it impossible for them to legitimately reconstruct themselves as you know, ecological heroes. You know, because, you know, a publicly traded company has to maximize shareholder value. That's, you know, we've created the corporations as artificial life forms, and we've injected them in this game of the stock market that we constructed. And as the rule of that game is, you know, you have to maximize value, shareholder value. So, you know, as a corporation, as an artificial life form, you know, just organically seeks to enhance itself, you know, it will automatically and necessarily attempt to evade or overcome or corrupt environmental laws, regulations, restrictions, and so on, if it costs it money and works against the prime directive. You know, so that's where ultimately we have to change the game logic and the game laws of the system as a whole. You know, that's what people have to awaken to, and that's what we have to bring about.
Is there anything you want to mention about some of the alternative economic models you mentioned before?
Well, we published two great books on this subject, which are available as electronic books or physical books. One is called Sacred Economics by Charles Eisenstein, and he really does a very compelling job of laying out a whole you know, alternative model. And another one is called What Comes After Money, which is an anthology that I edited, which has you know, essays by a lot of thought leaders in this area, including Tom Greco, who wrote The End of Money and the Future of Civilization, Bernard Lyotard, who wrote The Future of Money, and so on. Lyotard is also featured in the documentary that I made, 2012, Time for Change.
When did that come out, by the way?
2010, I want to say.
Yeah, that was a few years ago. That's right. Okay, well, it moves fast anyway. I want to, you know, mention some of the websites here. Again, as we begin to round things up, evolver.net, and we have evolverintensives.com, realitysandwich.com. Are there any other sites you mentioned out there or anything else, Daniel, that you want to kind of get out here to our listeners?
2012timeforchange.com is the film. You can order the film there. And evolvereditions.com is the direct site for all of the books.
Really good. These are links, of course, we're going to have up on the website. Go ahead, Daniel.
You can follow me on Twitter. I'm Daniel Pinchbeck on Twitter.
Caution in the next hour in our members area as Daniel positively discusses Eros Unredeemed by Dieter Doom, a sociologist, psychoanalyst, art historian, and one who had a leadership role in the Marxist left of the German student movement. Doom is together with Sabine Lichtenfels, one of the founders of Tamara. Tamara, according to the Wikipedia post, is a peace research village with the goal of becoming a self-sufficient, sustainable, and duplicatable communitarian model for non-violent cooperation, and cohabitation between humans, animals, nature, and creation for a future of peace for all. Dieter Doom places what he calls unsolved issues of jealousy, free love, faithfulness, longing, impotence, morals, etc. at the center of the question of true non-violence and peace. From the experience of free love, he developed perspectives for a new way of living, where love between two people no longer excludes so-called free love. Doom describes the philosophical and social basis for a culture in which jealousy is no longer a natural law, where sexual desires no longer have to be suppressed, and where faithfulness between two lovers no longer breaks down because of a too narrow vision of love and sex. Knowing love is the term Dieter uses for the process of developing a culture without sexual repression. And Daniel argues that we need a love revolution through non-monogamous relationships, which he says will aid in the planetary paradigm shift. Let's hear more about this in the next hour from Daniel himself, and you can make up your own mind about Tamara and the philosophy of non-monogamous relationships. Here we go.